time for the Angler Within podcast with Roy Bilby.
All right, we're back, JD, and just in time because it is Thanksgiving Eve, and we got a lot to be thankful for, and we got a lot to talk about on this podcast, so...
It'll be a good episode. Yeah. It'll be a good episode. Yeah, hello, yeah. Everyone, and thank you, as always. You know, I'm always kind of bummed out when I have to repeat myself and say, you know, thanks for your patience. When we when we have a bit of a quiet spell in between episodes, sometimes up to 3 weeks.
Right. Here we go again.
But, you know, life on life's terms, basically. Holy cow. Lots
life
of stuff.
Life throws you curveballs.
Lots of stuff. I was in a car. I was in two car accidents in 30 minutes last week.
In the same night. Yeah.
Yeah. And but ended up okay. Got hit by a deer. Front end of my car got smoked when I was leaving a local town. And then 30 minutes later, I made the poor decision to go down an unplowed road. I didn't know it was unplowed until I got on it, and it was too late. But
And this was the evening of the first snowstorm of the year.
Yeah.
We got eight inches of heavy, wet snow at our house.
We did. What about the same here, too. Same here, too. But it was an elevation event. The higher up you were, the more snow you got.
Right.
But it was raining when I left the town I was in. And then by the time I drove, you know, I went up 300 feet in elevation, probably, it was snowing like crazy.
Yep.
So.
Oh, it snowed at our house all night. We had to make an emergency room or a hospital trip the next morning. Had to have my father, who's 90, there at 6 a.m. So we got up at 4 and I shoveled snow for 40 minutes. You know, the roads were horrendous. We were 35 minutes late, but I mean, everybody was late that day, and we got everything done. So it was a mess. And I mean, you got hit by a deer. This is in deer season, for crying out loud, which our firearms season for New York State opened just a week ago. And I filled a doe tag opening day and in the first hour, so I have one in the freezer that helps me relax. So if we get weather in the 50s and 60s like we've been experiencing, I can slip back on the water and not feel like I'm cheating myself out of deer hunting, because I've already got one. I want another one, and I will get another one, but if it takes all the pressure off when you have one in the freezer, even if your goal is several. So but with one in the freezer, I can relax and fish if the weather turns what I deem too warm for the deer to be moving a lot. I'll just go fish and add some numbers to my count. I'm within 57 fish of breaking 37,000 caught and released since 1986 at this point. So we'll see if I can get it done. I do every year when I have a goal like that. So we'll see. There's lots of time left. There's probably 6 weeks left in the year, 5-6 weeks left in the year. I've just got to get out there and get on the water and get it done. My son's coming out for Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving morning, we will be on the water. And then after that, we're both in the woods. So happy Thanksgiving to everyone. Be mindful of what you got to be thankful for. I'm thankful that we have people listening to this podcast. And today's podcast, I'd like to talk about whether you are a competitive fisherman or not, whether you follow professional tournament fishing or whether you don't, whether you approve of it or whether you don't. You need to realize that professional fishing, as it is, has had a huge impact on the fishing industry that we've all benefited from. And I've got a few examples here to illustrate that. If it weren't for professional bass tournaments, we probably would not have many of the things we take for granted today.
Who is not in favor of tournament fishing?
Oh, there's people that don't approve it. The animal rights people, it's cruelty to animals, but those people don't fish anyway. people who don't competitively fish, there's a segment of folks out there that frown on tournament fishing. They think it hurts the resource. And in the early days, it did. The whole catch and release movement came about because of the third year of professional bass fishing. They would bring them all in on stringers and donate them afterwards to a local food kitchen or something so they could feed the hungry. They used to do that. They never went to waste, but the fish were all brought in on stringers. And afterwards there were crews that cleaned them and prepared them, and they sent them to food kitchens to feed the hungry. So it provided a service. But when you had that many guys on a lake for several days, it made a dent in the local fish population. And people would see the tournaments come to their home lake, and afterwards they would have a hard time catching fish, and they blamed it on professional tournaments. Of course, now it's all put and take. I don't believe there's a single circuit out there that ever keeps fish. Even the small clubs and groups like that, they all release their fish. The catch and release movement was started by the Bass Angler Sportsman Society in, I believe, 1972, the Don't Kill Your Catch campaign, and to get people to stop knocking the professional bass tournaments, that they put everything back. There's still people that don't tournament fish that don't think it's a good idea. They think it harms the fishery. But trust me, we appreciate the resource more than most, I would say, because we make a living off it. We enjoy it tremendously. And there's nothing more than we want than to continue that renewable resource and educate people on how to properly handle fish and release them so that the resource continues and succeeds. And I tell you what, there's a lot of fisheries now that the good old days are right now. The things in many areas are much better than they have been for decades. And that goes to proper fish care, fish management from the resource managers, and catch and release fishing. The first professional tournament, and we're going back, and I'm taking this from the BASS side, the Bassmasters Tour, the Bass Anglers Sportsman Society. Ray Scott, when he started that, he held his first tournament in 1969, and it had I think it had 106 anglers in it from mostly all over the South, different states. And he invited people to this to come and see who was the best fisherman. And that basically became the Bass Angler Sportsman Society. And by 1971, he held his first Bassmaster Classic Championship. And it just grew from there. But one of the things that was spawned, for lack of a better phrase, from those early days was, believe it or not, Bass Pro Shops. Everybody knows about Bass Pro Shops. Everybody who fishes is aware of it. I've been a huge fan for decades. Bass Pro Shops came about because of those early tournaments. There was a competitor in those first few years, Johnny Morris, the founder of Bass Pro Shops, and he had a keen eye. He was an observer and a good competitor. He made money in those tournaments. I think he fished them for the first 3 years. I don't think it was much more than that. Probably maybe the first 5-6 years, but his business started to take off. But it came about because they would have a tournament in say South Carolina, and South Carolina anglers would do really well in that tournament. And you had guys from Texas and Oklahoma and Florida and Georgia fishing these tournaments, but everybody had these different lures that were just unique to their own region of the country. And guys from Texas and Florida and Georgia had never seen the lures that these guys in South Carolina were running the tournament with, or the techniques. And then they'd go to Texas and somebody from there would win with a lure that was very prominent there and very successful there, But these guys had never seen it. And Johnny Morris said, there's got to be a way where, you know, we can get things so they aren't so localized. So his dream was to create a tackle shop where you could have tackle from all over the country and everybody would have access to it. It wasn't just regionally available. So his father had a liquor store, the Brown Derby Liquor Store in Springfield, Missouri. He got, believe it or not, an 8-square-foot space of floor to hang lures and sell them from all these different regions of the country. And he just couldn't keep up with the demand. So he said, there's got to be a better way. And he wasn't successful enough to build his own store yet. But in 1974, they produced the first Bass Pro Shops catalog. And they had all the lures in there that were available around the country. And they just did a mass mailing. And these catalogs went out. And suddenly, people had a catalog in their hands that had all these lures that they'd never seen before from all these different parts of the country, and they could order them. It was all mail order back in those days. There was no internet, didn't exist. Nobody had a home computer even, and you just picked up the phone and called 1-800-BASS-PRO, and you made your order, and it got sent to your house. When I got involved with Bass Pro Shops ordering in the 80s, early 80s, like 80, 81, 82, through there, might have been as early as 79. He established Bass Pro Shops in 1972. That's when he started selling lures out of the liquor store. The first catalog in 1974, and then things blossomed. And before long, he was able to put up his first building, and it's just taken off from there. So the whole Bass Pro Shops success story, the whole Bass Pro Shops empire, was spawned from the early days of the bass tournaments where people could only get lures regionally, and if you didn't travel around, you weren't exposed to these. His catalog exposed you to those different lures, and I mean, the rest is history. There's an incredible number of stores around the country now. For the longest time, it was just that big store in Springfield, Missouri, but it has grown exponentially, isn't the word. It has just grown in leaps and bounds. They have more equipment than anybody on the planet, and it's a huge success story. And Johnny Morris started that because of a need that he saw in the early days of professional bass tournament fishing. So that's one way the fishing industry has been impacted in a huge way.
So let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Did you know that whole history before you ever became a pro for Bass Pro, or did you learn that?
Yes,
I did. You already knew that the whole way.
Oh yeah, I knew all that before that. I have followed it from the beginning, for crying out loud. Yeah, when I first approached them, I went to them. The timing was perfect. I had no idea. I'd been contemplating approaching them for like 3 years. And due to circumstances with them 3 years prior, it never would have worked out. It would have been a dead end for me, but the timing was perfect. I like to say it was God's timing, because I walked in, met with the manager, and walked out with an application in my hand. And, you know, just a few weeks later, a contract in my hand that I was signing, going, somebody pinched me. You know, it was like a dream, and it was meant to be. And it is just snowballed for me. Now I'm in 3 different stores, soon to be 4. And just because I went and knocked on the door and said, hey, here's what I've done in my fishing. I'd like the opportunity to come in your store and just do seminars. He's like, well, we can do a little bit better than that, I think, and we'll take care of you. And it just snowballed from there. It's been a heck of a ride. I've met so many nice people in the stores. I told him the day we met. I said, before we discuss anything, I want you to know that I am Bass Pro Shops' biggest fan ever. And regardless of how our discussion goes, that will never change. I've been a Bass Pro Shops fan from the beginning. I think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and I will always be your biggest fan. And I'll tell you what, I've just become a bigger fan, and I pinch myself every day that I get to go out and represent them. And I am proud to be that person. And I hope I do them justice. I do my level best every day to represent them in a good professional manner and disseminate as much information as possible to help people catch more fish.
Well, and you know, hey, Bass Pro, if you're listening out there, you know, could always do us right, perhaps with a sponsorship, the show. Hint, hint.
But go ahead.
No, I just said hint, hint. That was it.
So that's one of the impacts that professional fishing has had on the fishing industry at large. I don't think there's anybody today who fishes that is not aware of Bass Pro Shops. They are the industry giant as far as retail fishing equipment.
There are
everything from boats to split shot.
There are people
in between.
There are people who have the hat and have never stepped foot in a store.
That's crazy.
Popular hat.
I think it looks sharp.
It does.
Every time I see somebody with a Bass Pro Shops hat on, I get their attention and I say, hey, thanks for representing. Now, here's something that, I mean, people who follow professional fishing know. Most of them would know this story. You may not be aware of it. Other people probably aren't. But hardcore bass guys are, for the most part. And this goes back, boy, some of the younger guys may not know this. Paul Elias was a guy from Laurel, Mississippi. He was a good bass fisherman. He was sponsored by Mann's Bait Company. Now, Paul liked to throw a crankbait, and he won a lot of tournaments getting his crankbaits deeper than anybody else, getting them down to fish that other people weren't reaching. He developed a technique he called kneel and reel. What he would do, he would get right on the front deck of the boat, go right down on his knees, and he would stick his rod all the way down into the water up to the reel, and he would crank like that, and he could get his crankbait about 6 or 7 feet deeper than everybody else by doing that. Paul was sponsored by the Mann's Bait Company, Tom Mann's Bait Company. Famous for making jelly worms, some of the earliest plastic worms that were flavored. And that's a whole different story. But they also got into making crankbaits. And because of Paul's success getting crankbaits to dive deeper by doing that, they went into research and development and redesigned a diving lip on a crankbait with his help and with some engineering guys, and they actually developed crankbaits that would dive down to 15 foot, 20 foot, 25, even 30 foot. If you're familiar with these, this goes back a long ways now, decades. It was called the Mann's Plus series, the 15 plus, 20 plus, 25 plus, and 30 plus. And these were crankbaits that were designed to get down to those deep, deep depths. Prior to that, most of your crankbaits were shallow or mid-divers. Nobody made deep-diving crankbaits until Mann's partnered with him so he didn't have to go down his knees anymore. His slogan on the commercials for these deep-diving Mann's Plus Series crankbaits was, he looked right at the camera and he would hold up the crankbait with that huge diving lip and he'd say, no bass will ever bring me to my knees again. I wonder if any of our listeners remember those commercials. I'm telling you, I go I go way back with this stuff. I've been following it since I was in my early 20s, and I'm in my mid 60s now. So I got four decades of just following this sport. If you're a guy who throws crankbaits, in particular, deep diving crankbaits, because everybody makes them now. Everybody makes them. Rapla makes some real deep divers. Mann's still has the Plus series available. Anybody who makes crankbaits has a line of deep diving crankbaits. And we owe that to Paul Elias and his Kneel and Reel technique, because that's what spawned the deep diving crankbaits that were all the rage in the 80s. And they still catch fish today. And I can throw you a story about that. I had a guy, he's a fisheries manager. He teaches fisheries management, professor at the college that I worked at. And he managed a couple bodies of water. They were old mining pits that had been reclaimed, and they bottomed out. I believe he said they were 28 foot deep to the bottom. And there were two of them, and they were rectangular in shape, and the sides went almost straight down, and the bottom was flat 28 feet deep. And this water was crystal clear. And he told me, he said, I want to put you on this body of water and see if you can figure it out, because I know you're a bass guy. And he said, this guy wants these, I'm managing these two places for bass. And he said, there are some huge, huge largemouth in these lakes, but I can see them, but I can't catch them. And my response to that was, oh, giddy up. I love a good challenge. There's nothing I love more than going on a body of water I've never been to before, have no knowledge of, and going there and figure out how to catch fish with zero knowledge or experience on that fishery. So we went there, and we started catching fish right off the bat. I brought like seven rods, and I brought big fish lures. You know, I brought some of those deep diving crankbaits. I brought my big jig and crawl, my 11-inch plastic worms, big spinner baits, everything I love to throw, huge topwaters. I'm on a hunt for big fish. And he made a comment about that. He looked at my rods. He said, man, you got giant lures. I said, oh, big lure, big fish. And he said, oh, I didn't think that was true. I thought that was just a catchphrase. I said, oh no, it's absolutely true. But and you'd be surprised how small a fish will hit these. But no, these are, if you're going to target big fish, I'm going to throw a big lure. In a tournament, the goal is to get a limit and then to have your fish bigger than everybody else's five. We always go for a limit first. Most people do that. They go for the limit first. And once you have your limit, then you go, now we're going to hunt for big fish. You can relax. You got your five. You're going to weigh in well, but you've got to get some weight. And that's when I go to that big jig and craw and that big 11-inch worm and those bigger crankbaits and a bigger spinnerbait, and I start trying to select for larger fish to cull out. So, of course, when I went to this body of water that he challenged me with, I went in with that stuff. And we were marking a lot of fish, and you could see them down in that deep water. I said, we're just not getting down to them. I got down to them with a jig, but they didn't want it. So I put on a man's 25 plus, and I threw it on 10-pound line, and I got it down there. And I caught five fish on it that day, but one of them was one of those giants. And it just goes to show you, those big fish, big lure, it works. And thanks to Paul Elias and his Kneel and Reel technique and the need for baits that would dive deeper, we all are recipients of that today if you use deep diving crankbaits. And that came out of the professional bass fishing ranks. So that's another way the fishing industry, as it stands today, has been impacted in a positive way by professional angling. Another example, and this was pretty cool, because this came about, I think it was the early 90s, like 90 or 91. Back then, everyone was using monofilament. And when I started, I was using monofilament. The only braided line we had were on tip-ups or on an old casting reel from the 1950s, and this stuff looked like braided string. It was heavy duty stuff. You're like, nobody's going to catch a fish on that. You know, they're going to see it. Looks like rope. But in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, there were line companies that were starting to develop braided lines with super thin diameters. I believe the fibers were called microdyneema. I would have to look it up, but I'm pretty sure that's what the materials that they were using were referred to as. And there was none on the market yet, but there was a company that had developed an 80-pound braid that had the diameter of like 15 or 20-pound test. And back in those days in the South, everybody used 20-pound test monofilament for everything. Good grief. When the Bassmasters came up to Lake Champlain, the first year they ever came north to Lake Champlain, back when they were sponsored, it was the Kmart, the Bassmaster Kmart Top 100 series. And first place was $75,000. It was 19. Good grief. Hold on one second. September 1997, they all traveled north. That was the first year they did pro-am tournaments. So I put in for it because it was 6 hours from my house and I got selected. The second day, I fished with a guy from Forney, Texas, Bruce Benedict, that was the owner of what was then called the Jaw Tech Lure Company. He made his own spinner baits, among other things. And that guy used 20-pound test on everything. And he could not believe I had, you know, like 12 and 15 pound test on some of my rod. 15 was the heaviest line I used. And I had 10 and 12 on everything else. He was having a fit that I was throwing spinner baits on 12 pound test. He said, good grief, man. He said, just put 20 pound test on that reel and throw it. Don't even worry about it. They use that for everything. So to have braided line the diameter of what they were already using that tested 80 pounds, that was groundbreaking technology back in the like 1990. And Randy Dierman, a fisherman from Texas, won a tournament on the Bassmaster circuit using that 80-pound line, and he credited the win to using that line because he was fishing heavy brush and he was winching those bass out of there. And he said he was using a jig pulling fish out of that heavy brush, and he was on some big largemouth. And everybody said, you didn't get wrapped up in the bushes. He said, oh, I did, but I'm using a new product, a new braided line. And they didn't even have a name for it yet. He said, if I got my jig hung up in the brush and I couldn't pull it out, I would just take that line and wrap it around the back anchor cleat on my boat, start the engine and idle out and pull the bush right off the bottom of the lake floor and get my jig back. He actually did that, and they had to, everybody wanted that product, and they were still developing it. He was testing one of the prototypes, so they had to put it in, fast track it into production, and they named it Lynch Line. And I mean, you tell me today who isn't using, you know, some of the high tech braid on their reels. I mean, we're all using that today. Monofilament is probably used the least by, at least by tournament anglers. Your average fisherman, they'll use everything. A lot of guys still use monofilament, but on the tournament circuits, monofilament is only used for like top waters and a few other techniques where they want a little bit of shock absorption. Some use it for crankbaits still, but most people, including myself, use fluorocarbon for crankbaits because it gets your bait a little bit deeper. Monofilament floats and braid floats, but fluorocarbon sinks. So it helps get your crankbaits a little bit deeper. And we use very forgiving rods that act as a shock absorber. So anybody who's using any of the high-tech braids that we have that are so, so common today and used for practically every technique out there, we owe that to professional bass angling, because Randy Dierman used it to win a tournament in 1990-91, and it was still in the development stages, but they had to fast track it and put a name on it, and now everybody makes it. So braid, floral carbon, those products, they came about straight out of tournament competition looking for better products for certain situations. Braid is visible, monofilament is visible, but floral carbon is completely invisible in water. You can use 30-pound floral carbon, they're not going to see it. It disappears in the water. But the braid, the diameter is so thin, a lot of guys use a floral carbon leader on it. I don't. I tie direct. They're so thin. They're thinner than the monofilaments that I use, and I still use monofilament for a few techniques. I do like it for a spinnerbait. I do like it in that situation because when a bass comes up and blows up on a spinnerbait, he's running it down, and he's got to inhale it, so that line and that rod have to give that spinnerbait to him while you're retrieving it. So,
what knot do you use?
On a spinnerbait?
To attach the fluoro onto your braid.
If I use a leader, I've got to work on my knot tying skills, but I hardly ever use a leader with my braid. I tie direct to my braid. But if I do use a leader, I use it so seldom. All I do, I use two clinch knots. The diameters of my two lines are so thin, I just pull the knots down, cinch them tight, and clip off the tag ends. And I never use a leader longer than 2.5 feet. And generally, it's much shorter than that. I know a lot of guys, they'll put a 15 or 20-foot leader on, and they got that knot going through those guides every time, every cast. I don't like that. I don't care for that. So I just tie direct to my braid, and I catch plenty of fish. It doesn't hinder my fish-catching ability. I have outfished guys using leaders. And the bodies of water I fish, there's only a few that are really, really crystal clear. And in those areas, I'm using 6-pound braid, which has a diameter of sewing thread. It has no effect on fish being able to see it because it makes no difference. I get more strikes on a 6-pound line because it gives your lure more action and makes the illusion more believable, and they do not see the line. I see absolutely no need for a leader. Now, if I was fishing on super highly pressured waters where these big national events are held, I would have to go to a leader because the fish are so pressured. But understand, where I live in the Northeast here, the fish are just not as pressured as they are in the South and where all these national events are. So I go against the grain. I'm one of the few guys out there who does not use a leader on my braid. And if I do, I just use two clinch knots and a short leader so that I don't cast it through my rod guides. And I'm basically an anomaly doing that because nobody else does it. Everybody I fish with, you don't use a leader? But, no? Let's count our fish at the end of the day and see who did better. Okay.
Roy the Anomaly Bilby.
So again, professional fishing had a huge impact on the industry by providing us with all the braid and fluorocarbon and super lines that we use today. We'd all still be using mono. Now, here's another thing. If anybody's bought a boat recently or anybody's been running a boat for as long as I have, you've got a kill switch on that boat. That's a safety device that it's a little toggle switch, hooks into a lanyard that you clip on your life jacket. That's why you ever wonder why a life jacket has a D-ring on the right-hand side? That's because the guy who's driving the boat sits on the right-hand side, and there's a kill switch right there on the right-hand side of the gunwale, usually attached to your gearbox, your shifter control, where you hook the kill switch. And what that does is it cuts power to the engine immediately. That came about from professional bass tournaments. They wanted to make them as safe as possible. And they knew that if anybody was ever speeding down a lake and they hit a submerged log or something or hit something and they get ejected from the boat. When that happens, because of the torque of the propeller and the way it turns, the boat immediately starts to do a circle. And what happens is, if you get ejected from a boat, that boat is just going to automatically turn a circle and run over you. And to prevent anyone from getting injured or killed in an event where they possibly might get ejected from their boat, they said, we need to make this safer. If you're going to compete in tournaments, you have to have an operating kill switch on your boat. That rings true for most tournament circuits nowadays. When you go through the boat check-in on the water, you have to have your live wells open, you have to go past the checkpoint, and you have to pull your kill switch so that they can see that your engine shuts off.
Oh, wow.
And so, then they flag you on, you hook it back up, restart, and you continue idling through until your number is called and you take off. But that safety feature that's on virtually all boats nowadays came about from a need in bass tournaments to make it as safe as possible for the competitors.
So what happens if they didn't have the kill switch? They were not allowed to compete?
You're going to have to ask me that again because my phone was quacking.
Who was it?
Walmart.
What would happen if you didn't have the kill switch? Would they throw you out of a tournament? Couldn't compete?
Yeah, if you don't have an operating kill switch, you're disqualified. You can't compete in this tournament. You have to have a kill switch.
Hmm.
Yep. You have to wear your life jacket when the big motor's running, even if it's only idling, and the driver has to have the kill switch attached. Has to. If you don't, that's a rules violation. You're automatically DQ'd. The boats we have today are safer because of professional bass tournaments, out of a need for them years ago to make it even safer for the competitors. And it's something that we all benefit from now. There have been instances, not necessarily in tournaments, but boating fatalities where people have been ejected from the boat because of the torque of the prop, the engine rotated to the point where it couldn't turn anymore, and the boat just did a circle and ran over them and killed them. It has happened, but it won't happen in a bass tournament. And if you've bought a modern boat in the last, you know, 3 decades, you've been the beneficiary of that. Every bass boat I've ever had, every single one since 1989 on, has had an operating kill switch. Every single one, even the ones that weren't bass boats. It's a good feature. I use it. I do hook up my lanyard because even though I don't have to when I'm practicing or fun fishing, when I'm not competing, I'm not required by New York State to wear a life jacket when the big engine is running. But I do that so it's always a habit. So I never make a mistake in a tournament of just hopping in and turning that key and going, oh, crap, I never put my jacket on. I do that in all my fishing. Besides that, it's safer. It's just common sense. It's a good common sense rule. That's why I do it all the time, because I want to be out there fishing the next time, you know, and the next time. And the next time. So that in a nutshell, that's just 4 quick examples off the top of my head of how professional bass fishing has impacted the fishing industry as it stands today. We are all the beneficiaries of it. Whether you approve of professional angling tournaments or not, if you fish, you're a beneficiary of things that have come out of that type of competition. And again, if you shop at Bass Pro Shops, if you use deep diving crankbaits, if you use any of the new high-tech super lines, and if you have a boat with a kill switch, thank the professional anglers. And yes, you are welcome.
So what's going on Black Friday over at Bass Pro?
Oh, man. Yeah, you guys want to do this. If you follow my Instagram, you saw that I put a little reel up there, a little video up there. I got that approved by headquarters in Missouri. They said post it on Monday, which I did. This week is Black Friday. It's their Black Friday week sale, and they have sales going on all week. the Carbon Light 2.0 combos that I use, the bait cast rod and reels and the spinning rods and reels, they are on the best price I have ever, ever seen. Just if you've been wanting one of those and been holding off, get it now. But here's the thing.
How much?
Go. I got to grab the flyer. I think. Hold on.
It's the best the price. I don't know what it is, but it's the best. It's the best.
I've got all I need, you know. I'm like, oh, now they put.
Well, now I want to hear what this is. I want to add one to my. I like what you got. The white ones.
Oh, yeah. Here we go. The spinning reel, the Carbon Light 2.0 spinning reel is on sale for $59.98. I mean, that's insane. It's got 10 ball bearings. You can get a bait cast or spinning rod for $89. They're normally $120, $89. And if you order the combo, if you order it as a combo, a rod and reel together, the spinning combo is $179. All right. Normally it's $210. But if you're a club member, if you have the club card, $130. It's normally $210. Same deal with a bait cast combo. It's normally $260. It's on sale for $229. And if you're a club member, $159. I mean,
is the club member only if you have that like wild credit card or whatever?
It's the club member credit card. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you gain points every time you use it, you get money. And pretty soon you got 30, 40, 50 bucks built up on that card that you can use towards merchandise. They pay you to use it. And if you're diligent and don't carry a balance and pay it off every month when you get a bill.
Sure.
It's free money. They're paying you to use the card. And you save even more when you use it on purchases like this at their special events. And you gain dollars every time you spend with it. So that's what I always did with mine. And for years and years and years, they gave me the black card because I was in the top 10%. And you see my basement, you'll believe this. I was in the top 10% of purchasing customers from Bass Pro year in and year out because of the dollar amount I spent.
Top 10 in the country? In the country of how much money you spent in that store?
In the U.S., yeah. I was in the top 10% of all purchasing Bass Pro Shops customers because of the ridiculous dollar amount I spent at their store every year. If you're not a club member, do it. And they will pay you to use the card. Just don't carry a balance. It will never cost you to use it. But here's the other thing they got going on Black Friday. This Friday, you want to be at the store early. The first 250 people through the doors of every Bass Pro Shops store will get a free mystery gift card. The first 200 people through the door get handed a gift card when they walk in, and any amount from $10 up to $500. They're giving away over $1 million in these gift cards all on Black Friday. So be one of the first 250 people in the store to get that gift card, and it's good on purchases starting in December. So do that, and more free money from our good friends at Bass Pro Shops, which came out of an idea spawned from professional bass fishing tournaments. That's how you bring a podcast full circle.
Sure is.
And thanks for asking about the Black Friday week sale, because it gave me a chance to plug it, and people still have time to do that.
Plug into Roy's DMs over at all lowercase Roy Bilby on the old Instagram.
We appreciate you listening, and sorry it took a while to get this one out, but we wanted to do something for Thanksgiving. I give thanks for all the listeners. We appreciate you, and we will do our level best every episode to help you tap into your angler within.